Welcome to the Udacity Thought Leader Series podcast. Today, Udacity COO Lalit Singh and Chris Xu, former HP Enterprise COO and CEO of Zeebo Inc., dives into why digital transformation is essential for the success of your company and how to best set your organization, processes, and people up for success when managing a digital transformation journey.
Hello and welcome to our Thought Leader webinar series. I am thrilled to be here with someone I deeply respect and I have had the fortune of working over the last 4 years. Chris Xu, welcome.
Thank you, Lalit.
Chris has very illustrious career working in some of the amazing companies like McKinsey, KKR, and prior to that, he spent about 5 years at Army after West Point. And after KKR, he joined HPE as the Chief Operating Officer of Hewlett-Packard and then HPE. The topic of our webinar is around transformations that the big companies drive when they are transacting. And this is something that you were at the front end of when HP decided to first split into two parts and when they also did many carve-outs, if you will. So share a little bit about us with us.
Well, during the course of the time I was there, under Meg's leadership, we separated HP from a $100 billion company into five separate companies through a series of transactions. And then we also bought several companies during that time and integrated them into the company. I led much of the transformation during that time, both operationally, but also the structuring of the deals and the execution of those deals.
Share with us the very first one if you have to look at it, this was one of the biggest transactions, splitting the company into two parts. And I remember I had just joined you, and this was like somebody, when I just joined and when we were talking about it, almost everybody was saying, guys, you must be nuts about even thinking about it and doing it in 1 year. Share, what went around during that 1 year and how did you and the team made it happen?
Well, there were times when I think we thought maybe we were nuts. taking a $100 billion company that was made up of lots of different acquisitions and pulling it apart in 1 year and standing up two completely independent and separate companies to operate independently as public companies was nothing short of remarkable. And, at the time we had 300,000 people, employees, and lots of other contractors and, hundreds of thousands of customers around the world and, 3,000 different IT systems. So really coming up with a structure, a process, and a governance around making decisions, having those decisions stick, and then executing against those with, I think we had at one point in time, almost 1,000 people working full time on the separation, making sure that every aspect from the legal structuring to, the separation of servers was done appropriately in the right phase so that we wouldn't disrupt the businesses in either one of the businesses.
Wow, that's amazing. And let's talk about the people aspect of that, because you said 300,000 people were getting impacted. How did the people side of it work through the transaction?
Well, when HP was just such an amazing company with an amazing brand, and it was considered a family company. And before I joined, I talked to a number of people in the Valley, and there wasn't a person I talked to who didn't have an uncle, a relative, somebody in their family who had been at HP. And in fact, when I ran the venture capital program called Pathfinder at HP, a lot of the entrepreneurs that we met were ex-HP employees or sons or daughters of ex-HP employees. So it was a company with just a huge footprint and a huge amount of breadth and reach and an emotional connection. So when we announced the separation, there was a sense of mourning. And, we had to really focus on communicating to our employees, to our customers, to our shareholders, making sure that we brought everybody along the way, that they understood why we were doing things, how we are doing them, and what were the expectations and milestones along the way.
How about when we split the company and then HPE became more of the enterprise-focused company. And there was effort around pretty much reinventing HPE, if you will. Would you like to share some thoughts about what went about reinventing, making a nimble organization that it became?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the major theses about why we needed to separate the businesses was that in order to really focus on core businesses and really differentiate and compete, we needed to have smaller chunks of pure play companies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, before we separated HP and then subsequently into other companies, we had essentially 15 different categories that we were competing against. And, you know, you don't have to look far to realize that all major industries in this world are being transformed. You know, Amazon came out of nowhere with AWS and fundamentally transformed the IT enterprise infrastructure market. You know, if you look at the mobile handset with the emergence of Android and Apple with the iPhone, you know, that market's been transformed. The cloud and things like Box and Dropbox and all these various different things have reduced the need for printing as we know it. So really 3D printing is real. It used to be a sci-fi dream, and now it's a real thing. Mm-hmm. So in every aspect of the business, there was major disruption. And so we needed to get to the core elements of pure play companies that really allowed them to be nimble, compete, focus, innovate. And so when we split the two companies, we then further looked at, well, what are the core elements of HPE that make it differentiable? And for HPE, we bought a company called Aruba, and it was really about core compute and about compute and networking on the edge and the storage that brought all of that together that really differentiated that core company. And then we had software and enterprise services. And those companies were better off with other companies that were pure play models and could integrate and compete more effectively in the global market. So that's why we did it, and that was our focus.
And then if we fast forward from there, 1 year down the line, I would suppose then we announced some spin-offs of the company, like we decided to spin off enterprise services and then the software business. Share a little bit about the thought process around that, and then I would have some question around the software business Sure. spinoff, if you will.
Well, I think maybe 3 quarters post the separation of the two large companies, HP and HP Enterprise, we announced the spin of the former EDS company, our enterprise services business, and tax-free spin merge with CSC to create the second largest pure play services, IT services company in the world. And the whole purpose of that was really, again, focus on the core business that I spoke of in HPE, but then to allow the enterprise services business to get more scale, focus, and be able to compete on a global scale in that market. And then the next quarter, we announced the separation and spin and merge of our enterprise software business with Micro Focus. Mm-hmm. And again, the same logic applied to that as well. And all along the way, you know, we were creating more value for our shareholders while at the same time creating companies that could be more successful on their own with more scale and more focus.
I remember that when we were doing that, there was a couple in the Hollywood that was going through their split. And is it true that their office reached out to HP to manage their separation, or was it just hearsay?
Well, we were getting pretty good at separations and doing them amicably so that the two companies post the separation worked together in a very constructive way. So maybe we should have.
Yeah, maybe that could be a good practice over there. Let's talk about, there's something interesting that we did during the software business carve out and spin merge, if you will, specifically around digital transformation. Would love to hear your thoughts about why that happened and what went through it.
Yeah, there's lots of reasons to do a digital transformation. And, you know, frankly, in today's day and age, I think that if you are living in old systems and processes, you will be disrupted. In our case, we were living on antiquated IT systems and processes that were the result of, you know, 80 plus different acquisitions that made up the software division. And we were using a supply chain, an IT supply chain that was designed for the manufacture of components, assembly of components, and shipping of components around the world. And as you know, software is about shipping code. And so we fundamentally needed a separate IT system from every aspect of what we did, from interacting with our customers to billing to financial management to our payment systems. And we had to do that for two reasons. One, because we needed to transform. And two, because we were separating from the mothership. We were a $3 billion company coming out of a $50 billion company, and we had to stand alone with our own IT systems. And so those were the two impetuses for undergoing digital transformation.
And I think it wasn't just the systems transformation or a IT transformation. There was a big component of the people and also on the process side. So I guess I would love to hear your thoughts around what would it mean for the leadership and for people in general when companies go through these type of transformations?
Yeah, look, I believe digital transformation is a must, but it's remarkably difficult. And it's remarkably difficult on a technology perspective, on a data perspective, but more so than anything on the people and organization and processes perspective. And just to give you an example, if you were doing a process in the past on an antiquated system, but people were plugging the gaps that the technology had, and the data was being cleansed and transformed and made effective all along the way by people interfacing with antiquated systems. But in the end, an invoice came out, or a quote came out effectively, but no one really understood exactly what happened. It was just people and systems interacting in a process that had just grown organically in and around a system that wasn't great. When you replace the system and the people don't know how to actually do the process anymore because the system isn't consistent with old system, and you actually think that you've designed something that works, but then at the end, an invoice doesn't come out, yeah, or a quote doesn't come out, or it comes out and it's got errors in it. You have to go back and rework everything. And it's really hard at times to anticipate how to make all the new systems and people and processes work together. So my belief is that you got to really prepare people for the change in the system by training it, by testing it with real people, using user acceptance testing over and over and over again, and improving the systems, making sure that the people are in place. And then when you turn the system on and you go through that digital transformation, you have to assume things won't work. And when they don't work, you have to be prepared, and the organization needs to be prepared to have manual workarounds while you're fixing the core systems, processes, and data.
Yeah. I think that's a very, very good point. And if I have to add to that on the people side, I think there is a component of getting people ready as well, right? Because this one required 15,000 employees in the company to be ready to be able to do work in this new environment. Retraining, reskilling is very critical, if you will.
Have to prepare them, yeah, that even though they think, because you're going through an old system that was really hard, yeah, to a new system that has all the bells and whistles, mm-hmm, their expectations are that the new thing is going to work way better than the old. And oftentimes in digital transformation, it takes a long time before you get that tuned. Yeah. And if their expectations are that when the light switch goes on, they can see better, you're going to be left with folks that can be disappointed. And you need to set that expectation that there's going to be tough things that people are going to have to work through, and it's not going to be day one ready to be much better than what they had before. That takes work and iteration and refinement.
And I think there may be goodness in actually figuring out some kind of training materials that would give employees a first-hand, real-world type of experience as to what it would be like working in that new environment. Like in our case,
absolutely,
we did have training, right? But it was more of a theoretical training. If there was a training wherein they would get their hands dirty so that when the light went on, they already knew how to operate in that.
Well, in a way, it's a little bit like as a software company, what we did with our customers when we were driving a digital transformation with our customers, whereby you have, you know, a sandbox environment or a user training environment that they can get used to how the systems work. I think that's a really good idea, Lalit.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm just putting a Udacity plug out here, by the way. That's what we do at Udacity. The training material we create at Udacity is very different, wherein what we do out here is in this future-looking skills, as companies are going through digital transformation, we create training wherein people don't just get the theoretical concept, but they get their hands dirty. They really get to create the code. They really get to analyze the data. And when they go back to the world, when they go back to their job, they are actually running from day zero.
Well, as you know, it's I think one of the keys to a successful digital transformation that unlocks competitive advantage in the capacity of an organization depends on the willingness of people to change and the willingness of the team to learn new things and apply those new things. And that goes from how things are done to specific content knowledge, like some of the AI and data analytics stuff that you guys are doing that can really help unlock digital transformation.
So let's talk about that, right? Many companies right now are going through digital transformation, be it bringing AI or ML or data science or just going to cloud.
Or even what I call little data analytics.
Yeah.
Just the simplicity of providing individual employees with visualizations of data that help them make little decisions on a daily basis and improve their lives and improve the lives of their customers and folks inside the company.
So where do you think is the most, I would say, gap versus the opportunity in driving this transformation successfully in big companies, if you will?
It's interesting. I recently did an interview with a large consulting firm that was asking a similar type question, and they were asking in a specific context of, there's a CEO that runs an old school, not based in the Bay Area, industrial sales business, and they want to do digital transformation, and today, you know, they're still doing paper invoices and that kind of stuff, you know, handwritten invoices. And, you know, they want to take baby steps, but their frontline salespeople are saying, hey, no, we don't want to do that. You know, we are afraid of disintermediation. And the problem with situations like that is, A, you have to actually recognize that if you don't disrupt yourself, you are going to be disrupted by someone else that's willing to embrace digital technology and people and processes and new capabilities, or that has a de novo infrastructure and architecture and doesn't have the legacy issues that you have. And so I think the first thing is just a real recognition that if you don't disrupt yourself, you're going to be disrupted.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think the second thing is the willingness to be bold enough to not incrementalize your way into things that 3 years from now, once you get that transformation done, are going to still be behind where industry is. And that requires a bold leader, a bold vision, a willingness to change, and a willingness to invest in upskilling and reskilling your people, which I think is an area that you guys are really have a bullseye on.
Yes, we do. So what would be one thing that an organization should do right when they embark on such a transformation agenda? And how should they go about?
Clarity about what the end state is and the timing to get to that end state is remarkably important. Because despite all the planning that you think you can do, and we did tons of detailed planning over many, many, many operations, even going back to my days in the military, but the plan always, something goes wrong and you have to change the plan, and people change and people leave and new people come in. And so the most important thing is having the end in mind all the time. What are you trying to accomplish, and what does good look like when you get there, and what's the timeline? And then to get a team around that, structured so that they're all focused on that common goal, and then let them figure out how to innovate to make it happen.
So what level and parts of organization does digital transformation affect?
Well, look, I think digital transformation, if you're doing it correctly, should impact all parts of the organization. And I think that what digital transformation does or enables is the ability to flatten an organization and to really start to streamline and remove those manual administrative processes that no one really loves doing, and creates the capacity for more customer-facing time, for more innovation, for more building of things. And I think that providing digital transformation also is about providing information to the right people at the right time to make the right decisions without having to wade through levels of organization or hordes of information, and to have that at the right place at the right time so they can make the right decision. I think that enables an organization to be faster, more innovative, and more customer-centric. But I will say that I think one of the things that I struggle with, and personally, that maybe is, and I see organizations struggle with it, is especially in Silicon Valley, and I think this is just the beginning of what's going to happen across business, is this constantly on collaboration, driven by things like Slack and instant Zoom, and it's just very hard to figure out whether or not to look at email, the notifications, your text, your WhatsApp, your Slack, you might have 50 channels of Slack that you're part of, and it just helps, or it starts to create a lack of focus. And I think that all the positive things that I spoke about around digital transformation are really critical, but you need to maintain focus, and you need to find a way to help your employees and your teams not get distracted by all the various different forms of communication that are always ongoing. Maybe that's a personal issue.
No, I think I kind of agree with you in that one. There's probably also some organizational construct to it. What organizational shifts are required to ensure that the leaders and the employees, they succeed through this transformation phase?
Listen, I think it depends on every organization, but I think there's democratization of information is a core key benefit of digital transformation. And I think by democratizing information and transparency, you can flatten organizations. You can go, worked with another Andreessen company, People AI, that fundamentally transforms the way that salespeople and their managers interact around activities and leads in CRM. And I think that will essentially create a district manager where the rule of thumb is 8 to 10 representative sales reps per district manager to like 20. Wow. because the information is there, mm-hmm. and you don't need that level of hierarchy, and you can start to flatten whole parts of your organization because they're all looking at the same information. And that information's all real time, and it's all driven by machine learning and AI, and it doesn't distract from people's customer-facing time to enter it into the system. So I think digital transformation is going to enable fundamentally different org structures that I don't even think we've really even thought about yet. But ultimately, I think you're going to have a much flatter organization. You're going to have people that basically are building things, people that are selling and managing that customer experience, and then people that are thinking about what's next for the people to build, and then folks, a very small set of people that are supporting all those folks that are doing that creation.
That's a very, very, very interesting point. And I think it probably leads to that, the startups or the smaller companies which are growing, they probably leapfrog into this digital age faster than the enterprises. And probably the path for them to get to that flatter, more empowered organization is probably faster than the enterprises, right?
It is, because they don't have the legacy of systems, processes, cultures, compliance, legal constructs. They have an idea and a desire to make something better or cheaper or faster. And they have all the tools of technology to put those things together in a modular microservices kind of architecture. Now, with AWS and Google and Azure, you can start a company like that. Like, I don't even need an IT. I've started a company with no IT shop. I just went on GoDaddy and like started a website and started up my email and my calendar exchange, and we've got a 0365 account, and you know, we collaborate on Google Docs for free and Slack and Zoom. That's, you don't need the infrastructure, and we're building a platform on AWS. It's just fundamentally changed, and so you can be more nimble. You don't need all the structure and layer and processes. And because you don't have anything, and everyone else has something, which is customers, profit, revenue, et cetera, going from nothing to taking customers' profit and revenue from the existing players is a lot easier.
Wow. So getting stuff done is much more faster than basically.
It is imminently faster.
Yeah.
You can reach out and touch someone.
Yeah, I think I totally agree with you that. You spoke about your military days. I know that you joined Army at the age of 17, and then you grew up the ranks pretty quick and became an officer. I think you drove some of the big tanks over there. Share with us some of your experience that actually shaped your leadership style during your time at Army.
Well, that's not the way I would describe it, but maybe just to put it in perspective. Yeah, I joined the Army when I was 17. I went to West Point. West Point is designed to develop leaders of character to serve the common defense. So the whole mission of West Point is to really take young kids like me who, you know, are just really raw material and make them part of a common team with a structure, a process, and a way of critical thinking that allow them to be leaders of character for the country. And, you know, that experience at West Point really shaped me in many ways. More so than not, it actually taught me discipline. I was not, let's say, the most disciplined young lad. In fact, I struggled to have two teachers write me a letter of recommendation because of my behavioral antics in high school. But, I learned discipline. I learned being part of a team. I learned about the world outside of where I grew up, which was Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And I learned how to lead people. Diverse sets of people to, as I talked about before, accomplish a common mission. I think I learned a lot about myself and my own limits and my ability to endure mental and physical hardship. and to lead others to do the same. I think those are the things that prepare you to be a leader, at least in the Army.
What are some of the daily routines that you still carry from your Army days?
Well, I try to get up early in the morning. I'm a big believer in, you know, the early bird gets the worm. And I still try to work out almost every day. I don't always do that, but I try and do some form of exercise almost every day. And I just think, you know, especially as business leaders, this is a marathon, not a sprint. And in order to be present and to be effective over a long period of time, you've got to be fit. You've got to be mentally and physically fit so that you can focus, so that you can learn to block, you know, out pain and distraction, and focus on the greater task. And it also gives you time to just reflect and decompress, because as a leader, you're always have a lot of different people and things and challenges coming at you, and you need that time to just reflect and recenter. And I think that discipline about, you know, getting up early and having that time to really work out, I think is something I learned in the military, and that, you know, I'll keep hopefully as long as I live.
Thank you very much. That's really good advice actually for us also to follow. So after your Micro Focus days, you spent some time at Andreessen, and I heard that very recently you have moved out of Andreessen and are on to a new adventure. Can you share something about your new adventure?
Yeah, well, look, I would just say that I'm, you know, grateful to Mark Andreessen for giving me the opportunity and really recognizing that, you know, I had the capacity to help build companies from, you know, from early stage. And so, you know, I spent some time at Andreessen really helping kind of companies in their early stage that were scaling, that had product market fit and were really building great institutions and great companies to help those founders and CEOs build their companies. And I got the bug. I became completely enamored by, I had been in lots of companies that had been disrupted by technology, and that we were always fighting against the competition and the disruption. And for a change, I got to be on the disruptor side and really thinking about, like, where are the profit pools? Where are the customer experiences that are just not great? And how do we use technology to enable a fundamentally different way of doing things that creates a better outcome for customers? And I've been a landlord for 20 years on top of that. And I met some folks that were thinking about starting a company and decided to join them. And we founded a company called Zeebo, which we're in the process of building and launching.
Chris, I'm very, very inspired by your story about, you know, leaving a corporate world, going into the venture capital community, and then within a few months, starting Zeebo. Tell us, share a little bit more about Zeebo.
Well, you know, I talked a lot about fundamentally changing customer experience and finding, you know, profit pools where, you know, the combination of technology and a fundamentally different customer experience can transform an industry. And anyone who's bought a house and has applied for a loan and gotten title insurance and had to open a bank account associated with the loan to do direct deposit, and then have to get insurance so that you can get the loan because you have to have proof of insurance, and you had to go find a bunch of insurers and do a bunch of different application processes, and it's all manual and all analog, knows that that process leaves something to be desired, and it's not a transparent process. It's not a customer-friendly process, and you're entering the same stuff over and over and over again. And you know, I said I was a landlord for over 20 years. You know, that process for landlords is even worse. If it's a single family home, there's a lot of things that are enabling that process for individuals. But if you're an investor buying an apartment building and you've got to assemble all those things and you're an independent, it's remarkably painful. And so what Zeebo does is it will be the only platform focused on landlords that it fundamentally changed that experience with financial services, from lending to banking services to insurance services.
Awesome. So talking about disruption, you know, at Udacity, we help organizations or even students who want to come, lifelong learners, who want to come to our platform and really learn these new future-looking skills to unleash their potential to take charge of their career. What advice would you have for our listeners today?
Well, listen, I think the best investment you can ever make is an investment in yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people are always spending a lot of time watching CNBC and investing shows and trying to figure out what to do to, you know, protect their retirement and protect their family and create wealth. But I think the single best investment you can ever make is in learning something new. And then I would couple that with taking risks. I think, you know, if I look back on my career and you know, I'm probably on my sixth fundamentally different career, like totally different industry, totally different job set. And I look back at the people that I served with in the military who are brilliant folks, and they've had brilliant careers, and many of them are generals today. But, you know, they went on one path. I jumped off and did something different. And then the folks that I worked with in my first career as a brand manager, many of them are still doing brand management and middle management. And I think, you know, I think the difference wasn't that talent. It was, and they've been super successful in their careers. It's the willingness to fundamentally learn something different and take a risk in your career that some people may perceive as crazy, but that allows you to get on a different growth curve and to demonstrate different skills and to learn. And, you know, part of the reason why I started the company I did was because I was enamored by disrupting the financial services industry focused on landlords and learn about that industry and find ways to just fundamentally transform the really crappy experience that landlords have with banks and insurance companies into something that's enabled by tech and is a great experience. And I think, you know, if you think about your own careers as, you know, the best investment I ever make is in myself, and it's about upskilling, and it's about taking risk, and it's about putting myself out there and trying to stretch and grow and always continuously improve. I think that's the best advice I could give.
Awesome, thank you very much, Chris, and thank you for spending time with us.
Thank you, Lalit. Yeah.